you all for coming today. So I obviously have nothing to disclose. So intimate partner violence is a significant social and women's health issue in the United States. A 2010 survey estimated that 7 million women and 5 million men are victims each year at the hands of their partners of stalking, physical and sexual violence. A more recent study that analyzed data from the National Comorbidity Survey Replication from 2001 to 2003 noted that 1 in 5 men report using physical violence against their partners. So much of the current effort and the work in the United States has rightly prioritized providing services and support for victims of IPV. However, despite the high prevalence and significant societal and health burdens that IPV causes each year in the United States, there is actually very little understood regarding how to best intervene with perpetrators. And in fact, more recently, group programs, commonly referred to as battery intervention programs, or BIPs, are being used as a mechanism for intervention for men who have been convicted of IPV perpetration. And in fact, to date, 45 states in the United States have developed formal standards of care for battery intervention programs, mostly based on what policymakers think are best practices for such programs. However, there is actually very little empiric data on battery intervention programs in the United States. So in order to sort of better understand the impact that such programs can have on IPV in terms of prevention and intervention, we need to know more, first of all, about how the battery intervention program process and what specific components of those programs actually promote behavioral change. We also need to understand a bit about what the clients, how they respond to such programs or how they engage in programs for better intervention and what they find useful. We also need to understand what best practices exist or what facilitators who work these programs think are some of the best practices. And then it would also be helpful to understand some of the challenges and gaps in services that better interventions face that could potentially limit their efficacy. So this actually draws on a larger ethnographic study that had several aims. One of the first aims was to observe and describe the better intervention program process and to understand the components of such programs. We also wanted to understand from clients, client partners, and facilitators' perspectives, what they thought about better intervention programs. And then we also wanted to kind of assess what factors were associated with better's engagement in such programs. So the objective of this specific analysis was to understand from the perspective of IPV service providers the challenges or gaps in services that they face that could potentially limit better intervention program efficacy. So our key informants were eligible for participation in the study if they worked in an area related to or directly with better intervention programs. And we were able to actually interview people from sort of a wide array of different areas that relate to better intervention, including administrators and facilitators, IPV victims advocates, law enforcement personnel, including police officers who are first responders, officials from parole and probation, prosecutors, and judicial officials, as well as social service providers. Our initial recruitment took place at 2 better intervention programs, and then we used snowball sampling to expand our sample. So we conducted 36 open-ended, semi-structured interviews, and our interview guides loosely explored questions related to facilitators and barriers for better intervention programs, best practices for BIPs, as well as the etiology of violence, among other topics. This specific analysis, like I said, deals with the barriers and challenges to intervention. So we used a two-coder iterative approach to reach consensus, and we used content analysis focusing on global coding of broad thematic categories and subcategories in order to analyze our data. And so in terms of the sort of internal programmatic challenges related to better intervention, we found 5 thematic categories that related. The first is structural challenges, challenges to facilitation or for facilitators, therapeutic challenges, challenges related to victims and particularly victim safety, and I'll talk about that, as well as challenges related to the client population. So the first thing that our facilitators discussed were, in terms of structural challenges, were challenges that were related to resources, and in particular, the need to find consistent and dependable funding for better intervention programs, as well as the need to be able to perhaps provide additional services, such as mental health evaluations or substance use evaluations for their clients that are not typically a part of better intervention. So as one of our participants stated, I'm very concerned about how these programs sustain themselves. So you can have the ideal program, but if you can't afford to run it, then it's not the ideal program. Another participant stated, we need an organization that you could do one-stop shopping. They could come and get a DNA drug and alcohol eval, a mental health eval, and then sign up for BIP classes because it is difficult. Most of these guys just aren't able to navigate those systems. Our participants also talked about structural challenges related to the need to monitor better intervention programs and ensure that they adhere to standards. So as one of our participants stated, without a centralized system and standards, it's very hard to track this. We need to know every batterer's intervention program across the country. We need to know if our programs work, and we don't have any long-term ways of checking on that. So furthermore, our participants also relayed to challenges that related to sort of the limited time and context that they had with clients and batterer intervention programs, and the limits that this put on them in terms of what they could really achieve or what the clients could really achieve. So one of our participants stated, we are doing the best we can with these clients for such a limited time period. We do make recommendations, we do call, we do confront these clients, but we can only do so much with the time that we have. So our participants also discussed structural challenges related to facilitators. In particular, they discussed the need to contend with available training and resources for better intervention facilitators, the need to contend with retention, as well as the need to deal with burnout and the dangerous nature of better intervention work. As one of our participants stated, a barrier, of course, is recruiting staff and having dedicated people to do the work. So I think that's a barrier. In terms of training, another participant stated, I think a lot of facilitators don't have domestic violence training. There's not a lot of training, so I think that part is missing. Another one of our participants relayed some concerns about the dangerous nature behind batterer intervention work, and she stated, it is dangerous. The people who do the group need to have a lot of support because this is not work that you just leave behind. I worry about the people that are running groups. I think so many times we don't have the supervision that is needed, but particularly it's the danger. And another one of our participators illustrated the problem concerning burnout. She says, it's time to hang it up as a facilitator when you can no longer understand. I got out of working with victims when I sat across from a victim and she was telling her story and I went, yeah. Burnout is what it is. I'm a strong believer that you get out if you can't see that most people want to change. So our participants also relayed structural challenges in terms of a lack of research on BIPs, and in particular the need to understand what are appropriate models for intervention, but as well as the need to be able to measure what constitutes success for clients who are attending these programs. So as one of our participants stated, we just don't know enough about it. What happens now is, oh, you are a batterer, let's throw you into this treatment. But this work is really in its infancy. I think it's so unspecified about what is useful and for whom it is useful, if anybody. Another states, that is the thing, like I don't know how we were able to measure this. You know, is this really measurable? I don't know. Whether or not they change, we can't really know that. I mean, when they leave out those doors, who knows? Another challenge, structural challenge, for batterer intervention programs that our participants relayed was the need to prioritize victim safety, and in particular to not provide a false sense of hope to victims that their partners would come home changed men. So as one of our participants stated, while the emphasis is on the victim, I don't think the victim is given justice. The court system essentially just slaps the perpetrators on the hand and says, don't do that again. Another stated, I've seen reports that say a client is not doing satisfactory in a group, but the client gets a thumbs up from court. So I don't want to send any kind of false hope to a survivor who's waiting for this guy to come home and change the man. And then finally, our participants also discussed structural challenges that were related to clients. Some of the participants discussed challenges in terms of dealing with client diversity. So for example, one of our participants stated, we don't have a lot of cultural programs. Do we provide specific cultural groups? Well, we provide it in Spanish, but it's not looking at the Spanish culture. Other participants relayed client challenges in terms of dealing with clients with differing needs. So dealing with self-referrals as opposed to court-mandated clients, or having men in group for whom domestic violence wasn't actually currently relevant. So one of our participants stated, if we had a group that we could put men with different circumstances in, if we had a way to meet the needs of self-referrals, it would be awesome. The self-referrals never work out. You know, they quit. Another, in terms of talking about men who are in group who may not be experiencing currently domestic violence, stated, I've started seeing a lot of guys who are coming out on parole, guys that maybe 20 years ago had a domestic, did what they had to do, but part of their parole is that they have to come to group. Or their most recent arrest had nothing to do with domestic violence. So that is difficult to manage. Like, how do you deal with that? Because it is different. So a couple of limitations. The first being that, you know, this was a limited number of batter intervention programs that were studied in one county. So it's kind of unclear as to how generalizable some of these challenges or some of the perceptions of our service providers might be to other programs in other parts of the country. And so obviously more research needs to be done on batter intervention programs to understand more broadly what some of the challenges might be for them. And then our sampling strategy also did not allow for examining themes by subject category, so we weren't really able to tease out if there were differences in perspectives between, say, law enforcement officials versus, you know, people who work directly with the victims or directly with clients. And then obviously this doesn't take into account sort of, you know, why men are in group and the unique men's sort of particular histories and how they've ended up and some of the challenges related to that as well. So there are a number of challenges that were identified by our team of performance for providing intervention at the program level to men who perpetrate IPV. So understanding some of these challenges will assist in developing solutions and strategies to improving interventions for IPV perpetrators and to improving outcomes ultimately for both clients and victims who are experiencing violence in the home. And I'd just like to acknowledge our research staff and our collaborators. Thank you.
Time for questions for you because you were a little bit passionate than I expected. So why don't you stay up there and we can ask you some questions.
Okay.
Maybe you could come up for some questions and we can open it up to the panel.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how much time we had, so I just tried to be succinct.
It's 20 minutes, but we'll have lots of time for conversation.
Okay.
So that's good.
Sure. Questions? Yes.
I have a question. In your county, does the court have some kind of requirement for what constitutes batterer's intervention?
That's a great question. So our county is actually going through a certification process that started last year, I believe it was. And they do have some sort of standards that they are looking for in terms of what is required for those programs and who can call themselves a batterer intervention program. It's been kind of a contentious process. But I'm not really clear on kind of, and I'm not sure that anyone, because it is a new process, is clear on the specifics of that certification. So what, you know, but it was done to increase sort of record keeping and all of the things that we think, you know, we need to know.
Right. Well, I was wondering, because there is a literature on this, like there is some outcome literature on batterer's intervention, and they have different lengths, and like they go anywhere from like maybe 12 weeks to a year.
And I think that really speaks to the need to understand what are best practices, like to need to understand, you know, what is an appropriate length. And in our county, we have two sort of different, we have one that's 16 and one that's 24. But as far as I've seen, there's not been any sort of solid evidence on this is the amount of weeks. And I know in California, there are programs that last a year. So there's a lot of variability in that sense. Yeah, absolutely. Right. And we see a lot of that in the groups, too, going back to that notion of client diversity and differing men with differing needs. There is a lot of variability in the groups. And we do actually have now men who are coming out on parole, like I said, who are coming into these groups, who have no idea why they're in the group because they've either never have been convicted of domestic violence or they've, you know, their domestic violence count was 20 years ago, and they did better intervention in their, you know, jail time. And so, you do see, like, clients with varying needs, like clients who have substance abuse issues, who have mental health issues, Yeah, and who have just a whole other host of things going on. And so it can be very difficult to sort of tease out. Well, and so, and our programs don't accept insurance, so the men have to pay out of pocket, and that actually ends up being a really challenge in terms of, like, financial sustainability for the programs, because they have to rely on the clients to basically keep the program up and running.
And does it force women to house the men?
Wow, and that's always been a sort of response from the people who work in the programs, that yes, that they know, you know, that a lot of times it actually is challenging because the victims are paying. Yeah. So with the certification process, our Department of Human Services is now providing subsidies for some men, but not all men are eligible, and it's not enough for probably all of the men who are indigent and can't pay. They do a sliding scale. They do provide a sliding scale. So based on income, you know, if you make, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but if you make less, then you pay less. But they are largely reliant on the men. Right. And that is definitely a concern in terms of thinking about prioritizing victim safety and making sure that victims, you know. Right. Absolutely. Other questions in the back? Yeah.
So all of the VIPs were male-focused?
Yes. Not in our study. There are in our county, but for the purposes of this study, it was looking at male perpetration of intimate partner violence. Well, no. So the programs that there are men who identify as MSM or who identify, you know, as homosexual in some of the programs, but there is actually a program in our area that is specifically based for MSM or for people who identify as homosexual, lesbian, gay. The court tries to send people who are self-identifying as that to the program that is for those groups of people, but they sometimes, because of lack of space or because that program actually doesn't run groups unless they have a certain number of people will find their way into the other programs. And so, that's also difficult to deal with, because I think one of our groups actually had both partners in the group at one point. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, in the groups, they're mostly all court-mandated. I'd say probably 90% court-mandated, the men in the groups. Probably about 90%. I mean, we have met and interviewed, because the other part of our study is that we have interviewed clients of the Better Intervention Programs, and we're talking to the clients themselves about how they view the programs. And we have, through that process, I have come in contact with men who are self-referrals, but the majority of them are court-mandated in our county. And you mean the certification or in our study?
Well, in the certification, is that a component? And in your study, did you encounter anything?
So one of our aims is to look at some of the recidivism data, but we're finding that's incredibly challenging because the recidivism data is not necessarily representative of, actual recidivism of domestic violence. It's underreported, obviously, so the numbers are always lower than what you think they are because, they just don't get caught the next time. But then also the way that things are sort of reported in the data, it can be something like, that's not related to domestic violence. Or sometimes the domestic violence charges, because there's not a domestic violence law in our state, it can be related to domestic violence, but it can be reported as something like burglary. And so then you're not really clear, is that domestic violence or is that something else? And so that's in terms of the study. And then in terms of the certification process, one of the things that they are trying to do is to be able to collect more data about the clients who are coming through the program, such that perhaps we can get a better understanding of recidivism. Because I think how that sort of process came about was there was a client who'd been through the program like a couple of times and then nearly killed his partner, and so people realized that they needed to start looking at, keeping better data on the clients.